It's time for a special session of City Council's Planning Board Working Group. Join us for City Council's Planning Board Working Group, starting now.
What's that?
The emergency?
Yeah.
Should I not be near you?
I'm not sick. I'm just trying not to get sick.
We welcome the growth.
No, Chris, if I took everything out of my purse, you would think I had like sugar and ever. I would be like, here's like.
I'll
shoot an email.
Steal
it back. They're on the free little like.
Set up a Teams chat. Remember.
Okay. The council is going to pass this out later.
He just gave me.
Do we need more chairs?
Okay. Hey, I just thought that was you. Stickers. Oh. I'm stickers because we all have the same laptops.
I did a salad. So, Council President, I did the salad.
Yeah. Do you know how to make them?
Yeah, I just do this like as a habit, and they're in my bag from a family trip. And last night during the meeting, I was like, I'm going to keep myself awake.
Oh, hi, everybody. Do you have that echo?
Okay. I'll go sit in the front.
You might have an echo in here, especially down with that Andrew. So here, let me stop looking at
it. Makes me wish we had like a 25-member city council. How cute would that be? Look at us all.
What, you want to expand council?
That's great. More people, more friends.
All right. Happy December, everybody. For those who may not know, I'm Council President Sandoval. Just joking. We had a long night last night, so we're doing our best to like keep up with everything. I am opening up my notes. So thank you all. Let's just go around the room because then I can help figure out who's where. Kaylin, are you going to help me keep Q on your side? And I'll help keep Q on my side. And then we'll pass it to the presenters. I think we're going to have a great discussion. I know this is talked about a lot in my council district. So hopefully it's going to be a robust discussion. Thank you all for joining us. Producer, do we have anyone online? Yeah. Let's start with our person online.
Hi, everyone. Councilman Chantel and Lewis here for Council District 8.
Thank you, Councilwoman. And that's it. That's everyone left.
Sarah Faraday, one of your city council members at large.
Good afternoon, Diana Romero Campbell, Southeast Denver, District 4.
Mary Coddington, Planning Board.
Darrell Watson, Fine, District 9.
Paul Cashman, outstanding District 6.
Alicia Khan Hammett, Planning Board.
I'm the council member for Lucky, District 7.
I'm Sarana Gonzalez Gutierrez, your other council member at large.
Amanda Sawyer, District 5.
Caitlin Fonder, Planning Board and current chair.
Deirdre Ellis, Planning Board.
Fred Glick, Planning Board and Vice Chair.
Stacey Gilmore, District 11.
Kevin Flynn, Southwest Denver's District 2.
Hey, Denver. Chris Hines, Denver's Perfect Test.
Jamie Torres, West Denver District 3.
Great. And I'll pass it over to our planners.
All right. Thank you so much. My name is Rob Haig. I am a senior city planner with Community Planning and Development. Thank you all for coming today and making the time to come down here. We would like to give an update to you all about the Unlocking Housing Choices project get some feedback on the project and the direction that we're heading. So first, we'd like to give a quick recap at the from the previous joint session where we all met. We discussed the project's foundation and background, which included a look at the adopted plan guidance, the issue identification, and some of the peer city approaches. So moving forward today, what we'd like to talk about is we have a quick presentation and project update, and then we'll talk about next steps. But generally, we'd like to get your feedback at this point in the project and get your input as we take things forward and begin to refine our strategies. So at this point, you've probably heard that there have been some changes to the project's timeline. And the thing we really want to emphasize here is that the project scope has not changed. So we still have the same objectives that we originally set out to accomplish, but we are separating the project into two phases in order to address budget and staffing challenges. This enables us to accomplish some of the key parts of the project within the original time frame. So we still wanted to have that, you know, original scope or timeline that we set forth. We wanted to accomplish something within that time frame. So this phased approach allows us to do that, in contrast to kind of delaying everything and not accomplishing anything until the end of this longer timeline. So this enables us to accomplish some of the key parts of the project that have the strongest plan guidance and enable missing middle housing for affordable housing when affordable housing is provided and when an existing home is retained. So to quickly go over the approaches in phase one, the first phase enables this more focused approach. In order to incentivize the retention of existing homes, phase one will allow additional housing options with an existing home is retained. This would enable more housing within a new structure or within an existing structure. It would allow the subdivision of an existing home or new housing units within a completely brand new structure. The second part of phase one is it allows for completely new structures on a property when one of the units within the new housing is set aside as affordable. So this would allow for options kind of like here, potentially two structures where one of these units within this two double duplex type situation is set aside as affordable, or three completely set aside structures, three cottage home type units, or one unit with one of these set aside as affordable in a single structure. So in addition to the new enabling of missing middle housing types in this more focused approach, UHC will also update our residential design standards to reduce building scale and promote more compatible infill. So phase two will then move forward with these options and enable a more open missing middle housing strategy with some of the requirements and the incentives of phase one, but some of them also might be removed. The additional time in between phase one and phase two allows us to engage the community, continue to build support for the project, fine-tune our approach based on, you know, concerns of individual neighborhoods, and kind of be more proactive. While we've separated kind of the more straightforward approaches in phase one, phase two will be where we kind of tackle the more complex issues of the project. So far, up to this point in 2025, the public-facing aspects of the project have been focused on our advisory committee, but we've also had good engagement on our webpage and met with multiple registered neighborhood organizations. Basically, anyone who requested a meeting, we were happy to oblige. In 2026, we look forward to expanding our engagement strategy to the wider general public through community meetings, publishing our strategies, and the continued advisory committee meetings. So now we'll take a closer look at those phase one strategies that I just went over briefly in the previous slides. So to take a quick look at current trends, when an existing house is demolished and replaced with a new house, that new house is typically over $1.4 million and larger than 3,000 square feet. This is not attainable to many people. But when an existing house is demolished and replaced with a duplex, triplex, or row house, the majority of those new homes are less than $800,000 and smaller than 3,000 square feet. Of course, the existing home is often still cheaper and still smaller than what it is being replaced with. But that's one of the reasons why Blueprint Denver calls for this project to explore incentives to keep those smaller, cheaper houses in place. And it's why one of our key project strategies encourages the retention of existing structures. Also, of course, that $800,000 duplex or row home is still out of reach for many Denverites, which is why the project will also include incentives for new units to be restricted at even more affordable prices. And we are making changes to our built forms to reduce the size of structures that are built within our residential neighborhoods. So unlocking housing choices can help residents stay in their homes and enable more attainable homeownership opportunities through these three key concepts. First is compatibility. We're updating our building forms to improve compatibility of residential infill. Secondly, UHC can improve the attainability of our residential neighborhoods through the introduction of additional housing types. Third, UHC can enable an increased housing supply in residential neighborhoods. And these concepts all work together, too, to create additional smaller homes that are not being built today and create more housing options for more Denverites to enable them to live in our great residential neighborhoods. And the compatibility and supply components will work together in order to ensure that new infill development is more compatible with existing neighborhoods than what we see being built today. So to take a quicker look at some of the three components of the first phase of the project, we'll focus here on this slide on the retention of existing homes. So this strategy would enable missing middle housing when an existing structure is retained. This promotes the preservation of existing smaller homes while still allowing flexibility for property owners and home builders to add value to the property. This would help advance plan goals in Blueprint Denver and multiple NPI plans that call for the preservation of existing homes while still considering the addition of missing middle housing. A home builder, for example, could buy a smaller home. They'd renovate that smaller home, add one or two additional dwelling units at the rear, and this could result in three more moderately sized homes, all for sale, than what we see today, which is a the scrape and replacement of that single home with one very large home that is built to the maximum of our building standards in order to maximize profit. So the second strategy is our enables missing middle housing when one of the units is affordable. So this would allow for a completely new structure on a property. This would be the replacement of an existing home with a missing middle housing type, whether it's a duplex, fourplex, or cottage court type development. This would require one of the units to be affordable. Our financial feasibility study, which is still underway, and we expect to see some of the preliminary results of that in early 2026, will be crucial in determining what level of affordability is feasible so that this strategy actually results in more housing and more affordable housing as well. So in addition to those opportunities for missing middle housing, we'll also be updating our building forms to better align with the size and scale of our existing neighborhoods. We're also considering establishing a maximum floor area limitation on residential development in order to both incentivize the creation of more moderately sized homes and incentivize the creation of missing middle housing. So our current building forms, as demonstrated in this image in the bottom right-hand corner of the screen, allows for housing that is much larger than what's typically already existing in these neighborhoods, in some cases three or four times the size of existing homes. Even something like a Denver Square is dwarfed by some of the new single-family homes and duplexes that are built in these neighborhoods. So we're going to right-size our building standards in order to promote more compatible infill. Additionally, the potential maximum floor size will increase for each housing unit proposed on a property. This will act as a financial incentive for home builders to build more missing middle housing types rather than large single family homes. With that, we'll take a quick look at the next steps. So the next steps after today, we are working closely with our consultants and staff to continue to develop these strategies and prepare our report and what we're going to distribute to the public so that we can get comments back on that. We've had great advisory committee meetings that are informing the development of those strategies. So now we're taking this time after a round of meetings that ended in November to do the work required to kind of implement what we've heard from our committee. We'll also plan on having public meetings in early 2026 with the general public in multiple locations around the city. And we'll share our findings and recommendations of our financial feasibility at the same time that we issue this strategy document in the first half of 2026. The first phase of this project, we're targeting an adoption at the end of 2026, which will come up very quickly. And we look forward to working with you all through that process as well. So that is the presentation that we wanted to give. Again, just a general update, sharing kind of where we are and the strategies that we are working on developing. Looking forward to hearing your discussion and also looking for your feedback on kind of how you think about these strategies. So thank you.
Thank you. So in the queue, I have Councilmember Parity, Alvidres, Councilmember Hines, Fred, Mary. Okay. I'm just going to take a moment of personal privilege and say that when I did the overlay in Sunnyside and in Harkness Heights, I'll never forget, I didn't think it was going to pass planning board, especially the one in Harkness Heights. We created a minimum floor area allowance. So we have this in a neighborhood in Denver already. I have it predominantly, like the biggest place that we have it is in Sunnyside. And we were doing that because houses were being torn down and McMansions were being built. And so the data that my aide at the time, Naomi, found is that the market drives it. And so if you have a bigger house, it's all based on square footage. I will say that I did do the maximum floor area allowance also on duplex form because we were getting duplexes. One just sold in Sloan's Lake for 2.9. And so that's what I'm facing in my neighborhood is a single family house was torn down. It was like a bungalow. It's like a Tudor house. And it literally each side one sold for 2.9 and the other side sold for 2.5. And I think they were like 5,500 square feet. And so in Sunnyside, we also saw that happening as well, where a single family house was being torn down and a duplex on average between 5 and 6,000 square feet were being built. I will say that what we did with the maximum floor area coverage was we didn't include a basement. So you can actually build down and you could actually have a basement, so you could still have a three-story house if you want. I know when you have kiddos, a basement really helps. So the basement is not included in my maximum floor area allowance. So if anyone's interested in seeing that at past planning board, it's been implemented and it's in Sunnyside and I believe the Harkness Heights area, which is at least we have some evidence of it's working or not. So that's just a little food for thought before we get into the queue. And thank you for the great presentation and thank you so much for the work on it. And I just want to acknowledge we have two council members who are on this committee. We have Councilmember Flynn, we have Councilwoman Torres, and do we have planning board members who are on it? Alicia? Okay, awesome. Thank you for your service and thank you for all the time that you're spending. I know that these are robust conversations. And I think we have some committee members here. I think we have Alejandra and, remind me your name?
Lucas.
Thank you for joining us. All right, first up we have Councilmember Parity.
Yeah, thank you. This is hard to be first. So here's my thoughts about this project. I've been excited about this, and when I look at the group that was gathered by CPD to do this, it's a very cool group of people. Like, that's a club I want to be in. I don't know. You guys elected a lot of very thoughtful residents on this, and it's large and robust. So a lot of time went into putting that together. And I have a feeling like we're all in that Spider-Man cartoon where everybody's pointing at each other. I'm too online, apparently, but it's a meme. Anyway, because I feel like there's a little bit of, I at least as a council member find these issues to be, or this issue of sort of like missing middle housing and like small unit density to be probably the most like policy and economically complex thing that I've dealt with as a council member. And despite trying to think and read about it obsessively for 2 years, it is just really hard. And no city has really like just sort of cracked it, you know? So I think I was hoping for a bigger menu out of this project and like a more analysis for us of like, here's kind of a lot of different things you could think about. Because otherwise, I don't necessarily have the tools to kind of like fully think all those things through. Like, I've heard lots of different ideas. And of course, most of those things, just to be clear, would involve like whether or not we want to allow market rate 2 and 3 unit buildings somewhere in some, under some circumstances, with some conditions, with some constraints, right? And so not having any analysis to at least think that through, I feel sad about that because that would be helpful to me, I guess. And I think that there's been a little bit of feeling of like everybody's trying to assess what everybody else is most interested in and committed to instead of more of the like, here's a whole bunch of options. And I've seen early slideshows from this process too that had a lot more like in principle, here's different things other cities have done that have to do with, you know, if you're concerned about replacing small one unit houses with really big 2-unit houses, then you think about what footprint you allow, like what you're doing here. But just ways to get at that market rate piece of things without doing something that's either too broad stroke or just that we don't know that we're gonna get results from, I guess. So that's one thing I'll say is just, and I know that also CPD doesn't have limitless staff. If you guys all had endless time, you are the people that could give us every answer to all of this. I feel really confident, but you don't, and I know that. So a couple like thoughts or questions. I also will say that like that the two slides about the cost of a new one unit versus cost of a new 2 or 3 unit versus the cost of sometimes the existing one unit house is like the description of the whole problem. And it's so interesting to look at those because in one sense, we kind of missed a tipping point where that duplex or triplex would have been more naturally affordable than that one unit. Like we've blown past that, which is fascinating in and of itself. It's been a wild housing market. And then in addition to that, we don't really control, like this kind of supply is really hard to think about in like a supply and demand framework because it's tiny compared to all the other factors that drive housing markets, that drive the supply and the cost. So it's not like us adding, you know, little duplexes and triplexes here and there at market rate is gonna just magically drive prices down because suddenly there's tariffs, you know. Suddenly everyone in the country wants to move to Denver. Like there's these other factors that just eclipse that kind of work that we might try to do. But all of that said, I feel like we need to, I still feel really committed to allowing a little bit more market rate density in the city. We are so heavily single family, we know that, but it's a question of where, and it's a question of with what breaks, you know? Because in the future, like that little bit of supply also should matter some to our housing markets, you know, all other things being equal. Might be hard to measure how much, but like it should matter because it would be new supply. And it's also environmentally sound. It's good for climate. It's good for, you know, like there's other reasons why we might want to see more density in at least parts of the city. So I guess, and then we, among council members, like we all talk about these things a lot. And I think I've talked with most council members about different thoughts of how to do this, including just the thought of like going back to our existing plans and seeing where they call for a little more small multi-unit residential density and making sure that we've even zoned for that, which we haven't done everywhere. Like there's lots of other, there's little bits and pieces of this I think we could do in all kinds of ways. So that's kind of what I was hoping for from the project, although I don't disagree with what you're recommending. And I think that the key thing to remember though is that like if that little bungalow ends up for sale, right now it's gonna get scraped and turned into the one unit, not the 2 or the 3. We would prefer the 2 or the 3. And the trick is like, you change the rules, you also change the incentives a little bit, and then you get more of the little bungalows scraped. So it's like, where's that little balance point, you know? But I don't think we're finding it with this. So, thank you.
Thank you. Next up, we have Councilman Hubbard.
Thank you so much, Council President. I will say that it's disappointing to hear about this getting pushed out over a longer timeline. I think that I lost the South Central area plan this year and next year because I was hoping to see some of the outcomes here that were going to allow for market rate housing. Another thing I really appreciate that Council President did was in our committee, she reorganized them so HOST could be together with our planning department. And I would like to maybe have them at this table. I've been digging into their numbers on their five-year plan and goals. And last week we held a Black homeownership roundtable because of the fact that the homeownership rates in the city are going down very quickly, and especially amongst community of color. So I did a little analysis of why the affordable for home ownership option is not working. The analysis I did was two homes in the same neighborhood, in the same zip code. The affordable one, deed restricted, has been on the market for over 90 days. And when I talked to Elevations Land Trust, they're really having a hard time getting people qualified for these affordable home ownership opportunities. And so the analysis here will show you that the payment on a for market and affordable house is almost identical. And there's also a lot of harms that are caused when we do have HOAs and these huge developments. And so I wanted to share that as well as just the difficulty of qualifying for some of these homes. And I am afraid that if we don't pursue market rate housing, that we will lose homeownership opportunities. And not only that, but wealth building opportunities in the city. And so I just wanted to share that information with the group for consideration and also ask that HOST be here. For the BIPOC homeownership rate in particular, the goal was to get from like 40 to 45% homeownership in a five-year plan, and it's gone backwards. We're at 38% homeownership. And the low to moderate homeownership was to get from 36% homeownership to 41%, and it's now at 32%. So I think that what we've done for affordable for rent is showing success, as we are seeing rent decrease as we get more units on the market. And I think that this has the possibility, if we could do it within a reasonable time frame, to allow for home ownership opportunities for people. In the same regard as adding units of affordable rental has brought that down, adding this market rate housing opportunity to young families will be helpful. And I also look forward to the housing needs assessment that HOST is doing, which talks about the number of bedrooms potentially and the other things that I don't think we're paying enough attention to. And when I think about the families in my district, they would like to live in a townhome or something where they could have a yard instead of a huge high rise. So I do think we are building not the product that our constituents necessarily want, and I am worried about the wealth building opportunities that we will lose pushing this out into 2029, which we have no idea what the housing market will be then. I anticipate housing prices continue to go up, and we're in a temporarily seeing housing prices go down, which is a really big opportunity for us to really change these figures of declining home ownership rates in the city. Thank you. Thank you, Council President.
Thank you, Councilman. Councilmember Hines with Board Member Glick on you.
Thank you, Council President. Thank you for the presentation. I imagine that you are also disappointed that that there's an extended timeline. As I assume that's fair to say. And we do have housing stability here, mm-hmm. just not at the table. When I think about combination of historic preservation, neighborhood character, reducing landfill waste, and additional density, I think of Cap Hill. You know, there are these large mansions that have been subdivided over time and to two or three or five or sometimes eight different units inside, one structure. So it looks the same from the curve, but has quite a bit of additional density. Is that something that we can do today?
If most of Cap Hill has, I'm sorry, I should introduce myself, Andrew Webb, CPD. Most of the zoning, or a lot of the zoning in Cap Hill already allows multiple units. So some of those existing very large homes can already be subdivided into individual dwelling units. Areas with single unit zoning or two unit zoning are limited to just one or two units. What is proposed here in the first phase would allow subdivision of a large home in a single unit zone district into multiple units as well.
Yeah, I imagine that would be we're reducing construction and demolition debris because you're not demolishing anything except walls or adding, bathrooms and kitchens and whatnot. But so that's good that's under consideration. Obviously, there will be concerns about parking and street use, cars on the street and whatnot. But I'd say Cap Hill has figured it out, and you say they're eligible for subdividing. I mean, what's that?
All right. Responding to the audience.
Oh,
sorry.
Good. I was like, what? The idea of being able to subdivide existing structures has seen success in Cap Hill, and I would say all the ones that want to subdivide have done so at this point. I mean, I think we'll have to wait until there's a sale of the homes that are still single family homes. For them to, all the owners that are currently single family, and there aren't many, I think they want to retain single family. But I'm glad that model is being moved outside of, the center city. So 80% of my residents are multifamily, dwellers. So only 20% of them are in single family homes. Both Congress Park and City Park West are interested in conservation overlay, the two neighborhoods where there are single-family homes. And I think particularly City Park West, they're okay with development, but they're concerned about, you mentioned McMansions, I like lot monsters. Either way, one of your slides talks about reducing buildable area. There really wasn't a whole lot of detail there, so I'm curious about what your thoughts are. Like, what does that mean, reducing buildable area and increasing density at the same time?
Yeah, so right now what we're thinking is establishing some type of gross floor area limit for properties, and it would be roughly based on a floor area ratio to the lot size, but it would not exist like as something someone would have to calculate each time. But it would be some limitation, probably for above ground floor area on residential properties, and then with each additional unit you create, you get some additional floor area. So right. So let's just say, for example, it's 3,000 square feet for a single family home. Maybe it's 3,250 for a duplex and 3,500 for a triplex. And obviously there's going to be a lot of work and feasibility study that goes into figuring out what those numbers are, but that's how we would incentivize and allow for more dwelling units while still limiting floor area. And our current urban house building form allows a lot of building. It allows a structure big enough for multifamily. So we think we can even start there and pare it back and still allow a lot.
So and it's kind of interesting. Isn't the 2010 zoning code getting away from floor area ratio? The old chapter 59 was FAR, and now we're saying we want to kind of go back into FAR mode?
To a degree, this is not something that is currently in, there's not a floor area ratio limitation within residential zone districts in the current code. And like I said, we wouldn't establish a floor area ratio. It wouldn't say like FAR is 0.6 for this zone district. It would say, lots between this size and this size, maximum floor area is this number, so that it makes it easier for reviewers and people to understand what they can do on their property. But it would be a new tool, but it's a tool that other cities that we've studied has shown to be a best practice and very effective. both at encouraging missing middle and discouraging Mcmansionization of their neighborhoods.
Does it talk at all about a structure fitting into the character of adjacent structures?
Yes, I believe that's definitely one of the consequences of that. It fits better, but one of the main, you know, it solves many problems, which is why it's such an effective tool, and that would be one of the things that it can help solve.
Yeah. Okay. And then just as a comment, I haven't been convinced to let this go just yet, but I think one way to help unlock housing choices would be to have a menu of ADUs where if you pick one of these items off a menu, then you know you get a green light, and at the end you get the inspection that just says you did what you said you were going to do, and it seems like that would kind of speed permitting, it simplify the city process, and help with determinants for those who want to do an ADU, and I think that would kind of help move along auxiliary dwelling units, just to you know kind of get the city out of the city hands out of the pot a little bit more.
So absolutely.
If yeah, we're thinking about unlocking choices, I think that could be a way to unlock choices.
I think you're right. We're exploring that type of pre-approved design for lots of different developments, kind of beyond ADUs and beyond as well. So we're exploring it and hope to be something we include.
The hard part is you have to go to Metro Wastewater and get a tap. Mm-hmm. And so they have to, I just toured their facility, and they are in charge of everything for a whole entire region. And so their board is not comfortable with getting rid of that tap fee for everywhere else just because Denver has ADUs. So when we did that ADU in Denver, they gave a report out on next steps, and one of them is like what you're talking about, but some of them are out of our control. And so I've really been pushing and like going to them and like, hey, I'll take a tour. And then I ask, hey, when are you going to update this? Hey, I'll take a tour. When are you going to update this? So I asked them to have all council members go out there for a tour so that you all could start pushing on them as well to say, hey, we need to update some of these fees that are out of our control because we can't holistically do that until we partner with some of the entities that have jurisdiction over us with these tap fees and all these other fees because they're huge. I mean, it's like a $20,000 fee where you have to get your own tap for an ADU. You can't tap into your own sewer. Yeah, so go take a tour. If you haven't, I'll introduce you. Next up, we have member Fred Glick and then with member Mary Connington on deck.
Thank you, Council President. I have a bunch of questions, comments, and a lot of this is really, I think, for later, for the next round of presentations. I'm hoping you'll kind of take these and run with them. And I want to kind of preface it by saying that I think a lot of what I'm contemplating here, a lot of what I want to raise, comes from a place of hoping that this is not just a tool that only developers are able to use. I think as we saw in Chaffee Park, when Council President Sandoval led the ADU rezoning there way back when, there were a lot of people who wanted these for a lot of different reasons. And yet some of them were developers hoping to make more money, but there were also a lot of families that wanted to have multi-generational housing, that kind of thing. And so I hope that this tool can be done in such a way that it is not so complex that only developers use it. I do think you know one thing that might be helpful down the road in another presentation is a little bit of explanation of how this differs from simply building an ADU. And I think some of it has to do with things like tap fees. I mean, an ADU has a reduced tap fee compared to an individual unit, or at least it did the last time I did it. And I think that there's some other guidelines in there, but it'd be helpful to see how this differs from ADUs and how this initiative, what this initiative might change about doing an ADU, I think would also be helpful. As you get into the form changes and introduce FAR and potentially more complexity, I want to be sure that we, A, are making it so that this isn't so complex that we're driving people out of the market. But I think it's helpful for us to understand and do some analysis around potential unintended consequences, how this might impact land values. We know, and we just talked about this last week at Planning Board, that, for instance, doing a lot split of a larger lot into multiple lots isn't always easy, whereas combining lots into a larger lot is very easy and is simply an administrative process. So there's a little bit of me in saying, well, if we introduce FAR, then those who do want to build larger houses, why not just snap up a few lots, and they're going to build a bigger house and end up having a bigger lot and take those lots out of circulation for missing middle housing potentially. So I want to make sure that we do dive in and understand those potential unintended consequences and what the impact on land values could be because of this. As we talk about affordability and this route that of using an affordable unit, I'd love in the future for some conversation about what that is really going to look like. I think it can be difficult for for-profit managers of these units and for the city to track affordability and affordable units. And so again, I worry a little bit about families that are trying to do this and if we make it too difficult for a family to do it because suddenly they've got these requirements and these requirements that they have to, these compliance requirements that they have to look to. And suddenly this family that thought it was going to be great to have the brother-in-law and sister in one unit and parents in another unit, suddenly realizing that they're going to have to hire a lawyer and spend money on a lawyer every year to do this, maybe that pushes them out of the market. So I want to be sure that we understand that. And that also speaks, I think, a little bit to understanding whether we're talking about as we do this, is this a route to ownership or are these only rental units? I do have some concerns about deed-restricted affordable for-sale units in from an equity perspective that we're basically telling folks of lesser means, here's a path for you to own, but not a path for you to build wealth. That only happens for those who have wealth already. So that's a bit of a concern. But I think as we go through and talk about this, I do think it's so critical to involve host. And I think we need to understand if you're building three units and those could be owned separately, which it's not clear from the presentation if that's an intent or not, we have to understand what that looks like from an assessor's point of view. I think we also need to at least touch on beyond zoning, what that looks like from a building code standpoint. If I have a house and I want to preserve it but turn it into three different units, does that mean that then I'm obtaining two new COs for it, or three new COs potentially? And does that trigger requirements that I have to do fire separation between those units? And does that mean that I have to upgrade the entire electrical for it? So if we don't explore these pieces, we may be doing a zoning exercise that isn't achievable in the real world, at least not for a normal person. Because if that's where we get to, then we are just creating another path for developers. And that helps by creating more supply. But I think that leaves a whole lot of people that we hope are benefited by this exercise out of the picture. Thanks.
Mary?
Yeah, thanks so much. A lot of your points, Fred, were kind of where I wanted to go with this. I think I was really confounded at this approach in terms of we're facing budget constraints, so we're going to take one of the tools that doesn't require any city funding off the table for 3 years because supply is, it's certainly not going to take care of all of her problems. We need a lot of tools in our toolbox, but it is an important piece, and if we're going to sit on our heels on that, which doesn't require any additional city investment per unit, it just seems to me like a strange way when we're facing like this tight budget environment. So personally, I would rather see, if we need to slow the process down because of where we are in terms of staff capacity, if we don't finish till 2027, but we have a full policy, I would feel better about that than having a partial policy in place by 2026. and then addressing the market rate pieces and ideally getting that through by 2029. Also, Fred, that question of like who is development for has been rattling around in my head a lot, and even thinking of like who can afford to subsidize a unit, and it's not going to be your mom and pop developers that might be adding a unit for somebody in their family. And then also the compliance concerns for deed-restricted units, even going beyond the points that you raised about scattered site. But also, you know, we've seen rents soften citywide, and now we're struggling with vacancy in our income-restricted units, because why would you want to go through the hassle of having to register your income with your landlord every year if you can find a place to rent that doesn't require that? That's hard enough for our experienced affordable housing developers to deal with, but if it's just, you know, I own a unit and I'm trying to rent it out, and now all of a sudden I can't fill it, that could create some really serious financial consequences. And I also want to lift up the fact that, like my favorite drum to beat on is that we are not in a singular housing crisis. We're dealing with a lot of competing housing challenges, and not every tool is designed to solve every problem. You know, this conversation came up a lot when we were looking at expanding housing affordability, and I know there were a lot of people frustrated that that tool didn't reach super low AMIs, but really looking at, like, what is this tool best equipped to deal with, and not trying to make it a panacea for the full scope of housing challenges, I think is really important. And then, you know, the scope of this, especially since the project lives in CPD, is very, like, regulatory focused, and that makes a lot of sense. But council members, as you're thinking about this, I think a bigger barrier to this middle and, you know, missing middle housing is finance. And there aren't a lot of good financial tools to build duplexes and triplexes and fourplexes, which I think is actually a gift, because if there were, private equity would be waiting on the sidelines to flow in. And so there's an opportunity for us as a city to think about how can we create financial incentives that give people who live here a leg up. And not only does that create opportunities to stabilize our residents living in our community now, but it'll keep that money circulating in Denver as opposed to being extracted out to, you know, the centers of global finance. I wrote my thesis in college on institutional investment in the single family market, and so I'm very interested in how the flow of capital plays into this conversation. I also think it's really important that we take a fine-grained approach when we're looking at this and not do a broad brush of, we'll just do fourplexes everywhere, and eventually that'll catch up. I don't think that'll be palatable for folks in Denver, and I also have concerns about how that affects underlying land value when you have a small single-family home next to a fourplex, and if that's a building pattern in a neighborhood, what that does to property taxes. So really looking at where we have SU and TU zoning now, maybe keeping that at TU and looking at fourplexes and slightly higher around our corridor so that we have a step-up pattern as we get to the areas of higher density in our city. And then really looking at opportunities to balance stabilizing people and giving them the opportunity to stay if they want to, preserving adaptability and not freezing our communities in place. I'm concerned that if we have a lot of income-restricted units, and we're seeing this with how the state's rolled out funding for for-sale housing that can't be sold right away because market conditions changed. So those units sit vacant because the people who built them aren't allowed to rent them out. And so being really considerate when we're deed-restricting units, are those responsive to market conditions as they change? Or again, are we saddling people with units that are going to sit vacant while we're in the middle of having so many people who can't find affordable housing? So those are my thoughts and comments. Thanks for the time.
Thank you. Council Pro Tem Romero Campbell.
Thank you, Madam President, and thank you, Mary. I have so many questions to what you said. A lot of the issues that I had have already been raised. I think in Southeast Denver, I'm trying not to get caught up on slide 15. I know it's just a depiction and so forth. I'm really focused on it right now. But I think about what is happening. And what's happening is, I guess it's part of that subdividing conversation, but people aren't tearing down the houses. There are 3, 4, and 5 bedroom homes. They are renting and leasing out rooms, basements, etc. And so I know. It's just a reality. I know there's that always comes up, and people are like, I can't do that. But it's what's happening. And so that's more of the issue, I think, that we're facing in Southeast Denver, at least, as far as how lots are being used. There isn't the question that you raised, Fred, about the difference with ADUs and how this differs and what that form was. There was a long process to decide what that looked like. And so I'm just trying to grapple with, like, what does that look like in District 4? And so those are more of my questions and or concerns about what does this look like in a very practical way for the residents that live in Southeast Denver. You said adaptability, Mary, and I don't know if you mean accessibility, excuse me, let me go back to what you said. Adaptability, but what I heard in my mind was also homes and their accessibility. So we have a lot of folks who are aging in place, who are aging in their homes because they are comfortable in that space and they're not moving. My mom was one of them. It was a place where we could all gather. And that's great and that's fine, but also finding those places where people can still, you know, age in community and then taking those spaces so that those houses could be more accessible. I think we often talk about building form on the outside. We don't always talk about building form on the inside that would allow people to move into a home and stay in that home. And not have to move because they can't make it up the stairs, or the bathroom door isn't wide enough, or, you know, you can't convert it, your tub into a shower, or whatever the case may be. And I think that's a very nuanced way maybe to look at how people are using how people are in their homes, able to stay in their homes, and then think about their transition into other places in community.
Is that it?
Mm-hmm. That's all.
Thank you.
Councilmember Flynn, Councilmember
Barron. Madam President, tell me how Capitol Hill solved the parking problem. So I apologize. I almost swallowed my tongue there. My son lived at 11th and Pearl, my youngest son. For a number of years, and he was kitchen manager at Crema. And every night when he would come home, he had to park up to five blocks away. So let me know how that got solved. I want to synthesize what Councilwoman Parity and Mary said and just broach the issue of looking at our adopted plans and where they intentionally said they want density in the first place. Because a lot of the guidance in Blueprint and in the NPIs, a blanket allowance for the proposed changes to allow missing middle housing on any single family lot in the city cannot possibly be found consistent with our adopted plans. It's dead on arrival.
Because Blueprint doesn't say that. It says, look at locations. It says, in fact, it literally says that two-unit uses are not appropriate in all low residential areas. I think it's misworded. It should say not all single-unit areas are appropriate for two units. I like what it says now, but that's not what you meant. But then also, when I look at the NPIs, the first one that passed is the Councilman Gilmore's district, the far northeast. There literally is guidance in that plan that says these low residential single unit, these areas are not appropriate for duplex. So here we're talking about building up to quads when we have guidance that says you can't even do a two unit. In suburban context, though, the guidance is very clear. And last night we adopted the Far Southwest plan, and it gives clear guidance for where we can have missing middle all over, in places where we intentionally planned it, because in suburban context, the guidance specifically is that intensities of residential uses are separate, generally speaking. There are some exceptions, but when I look at all the duplex, triplex, and I have a few quads in my district, but when I look at all the duplexes that went in on along Kipling and Stanford area in my neighborhood, and over in the Fort Logan neighborhood, they are in an area that is zoned for it because we planned it to be there. So we've done 1, 2, 3, 4. We've done 7 MPIs now, and every single one of them has guidance that will not be consistent with a blanket allowance of up to 4 units on any single-family lot in the city. So I'm urging us to look at, as the councilwoman said, to look at our adopted plans and say, where are these going to work? We just recommended in the Far Southwest plan upzoning all along Federal Boulevard. I still have single-family homes on Federal Boulevard, for crying out loud. That's an area that is ripe for row house, duplex, triplex, quadplex, row house, multifamily. We just dedicated the All Saints senior housing apartments. It works there. And for a couple blocks all the way to Decatur and to Irving on either side where they're doing the bus rapid transit. West Evans between Federal and the river. All along the centers and corridors, which is the guidance in Far Northeast and every NPI since then. And so I would ask that maybe in the next couple of advisory committee meetings that we take a look at location analysis rather than saying how can we put a quadplex into an area where the plan guidance says you shouldn't be doing it. Thank you.
Thank you. So just so we're clear, I have Councilman Sawyer, Councilman Torres, Councilman Gilmore, Councilmember Watson, Member Alicia, and then again in the queue, Alvidrez, but I'm going to go first around everyone who hasn't gotten the queue first, and then go back around. Am I missing anyone? All right. Councilwoman Sawyer?
I was going to say something else, but first I'm going to just respond to Councilmember Flynn because he literally asked my question, right? We came across this with the East Area Plan in 2021. Blueprint Denver says, and I quote, single unit districts shall remain primarily single unit. Comp 2040 says that, right? All of our area plans say that because our area plans have to be consistent with our overarching plans. And that is what our overarching plans say. And they say that because that is what our residents said they wanted during a 2.5 year process, 2017, 2018, to create Blueprint Denver. That happened. So I understand the desire for advocacy around just getting rid of, you know, single unit zoning in our city altogether. That's not what our residents said that they wanted, and we are elected to represent our residents. Also, that's not what our plans say, because that's not what our residents said that they wanted, and our criteria literally requires that we follow our adopted plans. So that is, I think, a concerning start to this conversation. I also will say, I believe that there has to be a way, right? In the near Southeast area plan, we have entire sections, swaths of Southeast, where the potential to go to 2 units is there. That is what our adopted plans say. Had conversations with the community said, yep, we're willing to do that in these locations. That is what we agree to and we want that. That's the suburban context where there is no form that allows you to build a duplex. So if we want to talk about like building forms, let's start with a real easy one that actually allows us to implement the plans that already exist, right? And I think that, you know, even if we were to do that, we need to come up with a clear financial picture. And I appreciate the information you guys have provided today, but I need to see the analysis piece that you guys said is coming and maybe our next meeting, because we can talk about plans in a vacuum all we want. This is all market driven. It all has to do with the cost of land, the cost of labor, and the cost of materials. And if it doesn't work in the market, it doesn't matter what we say here around this table, because it has to actually be reflected in a functional market. And I'm not sure that this is. I have not in my time seen developers to be particularly innovative. So what does that mean? It means that this is a really nice theoretical idea that developers are never going to do. What they're going to do is what they have already been doing, scraping an attainable $750,000 1940s bungalow and building either row homes or a McMansion. And if they build the McMansion piece, then that accelerates gentrification and displacement because we've lost that attainable unit. If they build row homes, they're going to charge $800 to $1.4 million for each of those row homes and walk away with a lot of money, and we are going to displace one family for all of those. So the fixes here, I said this to you guys in our briefing, and I'm just going to say it so everyone else can hear it, right? My question for them in my briefing, and I'm going to ask you all the same thing, is what is our return on investment with this plan that we have in place right now, right? We are paying contractors to consultants to go out and do market analyses. We are covering staff time with this. What is our return on investment? No offense to DRC, but the only place this is going to be successful is Southeast Denver, because Southeast Denver is the only place that has lots large enough to do this on. So it's only coming to you, right? So I just want to be really clear that...
Well, that's what I'm looking at, 15.
Yeah, 100%. Like, that's, I would be real scared of slide 15 if I were you, too, because this is only coming to your district. So if our ROI is 15 of these in District 4, that is not a good use of our staff time, and it's not a good use of our city dollars. So what I would like to see us do instead of this is address the micro fixes that really need to be addressed to get us the bang for our buck that we need. So what is that? That is figuring out the 2-9 issue we have been talking about for 5.5 years now. Changing the building forms in the right way so that you can actually rezone some of these units in Southeast Denver that could be potentially future zoning for duplex, where you couldn't build a duplex even if it was zoned for duplex. Talk about a maximum square footage. Maximum square foot, Golden has one, 3,000 square feet, not including the basement. It makes absolute sense. We have enough McMansions, right? And then there's something else we haven't talked about here, which is missing middle housing could also include multi-unit housing with extra additional bedrooms. We know our market is not building that right now. It's building one bedrooms and it's building studios. That is not what people want. That's why they're sitting empty. If we could find a way to incentivize 3- and 4- bedroom units being built into our multi-unit developments, that's missing middle housing too. It is. It's just not something we talk about. So I really appreciate the work that you guys have done, and I cannot wait to see the actual numbers that come through the next time around. But I'm really concerned about this project because I think we are not getting the ROI we need for the crisis we have when it comes to missing middle housing with the plan that we're looking at here. I also don't think we're going to get buy-in from our residents on it. Definitely not. Thanks.
Thank you, Councilman. Next up, we have Councilman Sawyer. No. With Taurus, with Gilmore on deck.
Okay, thank you. So just for my council colleagues, I'm not sure if Planning Board have already seen it or not, but I just shared the Pier City comp sheet and report that was made available to us in the committee meeting, just for your information. And when it came to our plan, so a couple of my comments or responses to some of the things that I've heard so far. When it came to the West Area plan, we were not a plan where all residents said they only wanted single unit in single unit zoning. They wanted access to remain in West Denver. They wanted access to affordability for a family unit, right? And so, like, I've been trying to rack my brain along with CPD in partnership to try to figure out how are we actually delivering what they say they want out of a plan that opened up a lot of entitlement. So that's why we have the memo in place, which is not a moratorium on rezonings. And I'm constantly letting folks know that we've had 4 that have already come through in West Area neighborhoods. And so that process actually leads me to your comment about really desiring flexibility when we have deed restrictions. So, Laya, I think that flags something for us to have a conversation about, because all of those now have deeds, right? They all now have a covenant that says we will make a unit available at a particular amount. And the amount, coincidentally, is about what they paid for the lot. So you're replacing at least one of the five units with a like for like, right? A three-bedroom, 1,200 square foot a unit at a rate that you might have needed to pay if it was a one-bedroom, small 900 square foot house in my district. But I recognize I don't want us locked into concrete when it comes to something like that. I do want it to be flexible, but that is our one tool, right, to try to guarantee something will be non-market, non-luxury in my district when they're building. And so I do want to think about how do we do that differently, especially if one of the recommendations from this committee is guaranteeing one unit is accessible or affordable or at some level. I mean, we're not talking about 50% AMI. We're talking more like 100% AMI, right? It is replacing that single family home with a like option. So that just, I'll just say that. The missing piece for me, and I appreciate Councilwoman Sawyer bringing up the 2-9. I think that is still the missing piece for me, and it is where we are going to see, it's where gentrification took place for Northwest Denver. It's where we're going to see it hit West Denver the hardest. It's the development that happens within that range of housing that is going to push residents out and give them no new option. And I don't accept a lot of the narrative that I hear from other residents who are like, just build and let the chips fall where they may. I can't accept that, because that means my residents have to leave in order for that to happen. So part of the missing piece is that we don't offer a lot of options. We have a huge gap, right? We have SU means SU. Duplex or tandem requires TU. We don't have anything that allows for triplex or quad other than RH or MU, as far as I can tell. So I feel like there's a huge gap there when it comes to what can be offered. The product in D3, and this goes to Councilwoman Alvidrez, your piece, it's always up to them whether they're gonna offer it for sale or rent. Like, I don't know how we structure something in the zoning code that leads them towards sale, right? In some cases, the rent is going to get them their investment money faster and bigger than offering them for sale. That's part of where I struggle. I will say, though, what we've rezoned, they're planning to offer for sale. Condos are getting built in my district for sale. They're just smaller footprint. It's like 20 as opposed to like 50 or 60, right? So it is smaller footprint, but they're doing that on their own. So I don't know if that it helps. It's definitely something that I feel like is a good thing that folks are willing to experiment with. And I guess my last comment is, I think it's really important for us not just to pay attention to what people in our district say they don't want, but how they're using housing now. And the way that I respond to that in my district is people are doubled up in District 3. It's why we've pushed really hard on ADUs and in the financial products to make ADUs accessible to folks. Per Tem, when I hear you kind of mention people are occupying or renting bedrooms, that's how they want to be living. Like, that is a use that I think we have to respond to, as opposed to say, it's not what we want.
Oh, I'm not saying.
I'm just.
It's what's happening, and
what's happening,
and it's not a bad thing.
And we had this conversation when it came to group living a lot about how people want to be living, is something for us to respond to as well. So, I was just hearing some things that I wanted to make sure were. They just added some residents from West Denver. So, thank you.
Thank you, Councilman Gummer with Watson on deck.
Thank you, Council President. Thank you for the report out. And yeah, when I look at District 11 and Montbello and Green Valley Ranch, for the last 10 years, have worked really, really hard to mitigate involuntary displacement. I mean, we made it through the biggest growth in the city from 2015 to 2019 that I've really ever seen in the far Northeast, and we didn't have people displaced. And, you know, I use my own family as an example. We have a single family home in Montbello that's a home that we've brought up our kids in, but I now have a 29-year-old, a 27-year-old, and I'll be having a 21-year-old returning in May, and my husband and I. And we all live in the same home, and that is our choice. My kids don't want to leave. They want to stay and help us. And there's two sets of stairs in the home. So we've already talked about that when it gets too hard, for us to go up two flights of stairs, we'll move to a second level so that we can have the kitchen and we can, you know, take care of each other. And so the assumption that people want to build or be in a brand new quadplex, I don't know if that resonates with me or my constituents at all, because honestly what you're saying is that if they're looking at something like that, they're at least looking at a 20 or 30 year loan. If not, on homes now, people are taking out 50 year mortgages because they can't afford the monthly mortgage cost on a 30-year mortgage. And our mortgage and finance companies are doing 50-year mortgages, which I don't see how you ever pay off a structure and get out from underneath that mortgage. And so the multiple people who are living in our house, we all know we had a loss of income in our home. And so I'm the only breadwinner in our house, other than my two other kids, who are helping us. And that's how we want to live. We want to be around each other. And if we could afford to build an ADU out in our backyard, we would. But I don't know if I want to use our retirement funds to be paying off a mortgage for an ADU or a cost of that. And so I think really going out to the neighborhoods, like this is a really great academic exercise, but to get out in the neighborhoods talking with people, I think you'll hear very, very different things around this. And it's not the new, it's preserving what is there, because the homes at the front side of Montbello are brick built. And so right away when you started talking, I would love to know what the carbon footprint is going to be around if you get X number of duplex, triplex, fourplex, whatever, and you've got to remove and scrape previous properties. We right now in the city don't have a way to even recycle that. So it's all going to end up out at Dad's, and then we've created more waste. And so I think it's a much deeper conversation than we've been able to go into it. But just wanted to give a little bit of flavor on that. And the other piece that I think about is life and safety. We don't have any alleyways in Montbello. So if somebody has a quadplex and there's a fire on the backside on the second story, I don't know, there's not like a boom arm on a fire truck. How do they even get to that back portion of it? You'd be going through fences, I guess. I don't know, but those are some of my initial thoughts on it. Thank you. Thank you, Council President.
Thank you. Next up, we have Council Member Watson and Board Member Alicia. After.
Thank you, Council President. I want to say thank you for the presentation. Great information, and it's a lot that we are, you know, struggling with on the east side as to what missing middle means. I want to first start by responding, not even responding, but elevating Councilmember Alvidra's some of the work that you and your team and my team has as lead in on. One of the points that the council member made on affordability as far as wealth building, it's not specific to this dialogue, but I thought I would provide an illustration. We have a condo for sales in District 9. We have two condominiums that are being built, and I think it's going to be about a 80 or so condos, maybe a little bit less, 50 to 80. The Charles Burrell and Hattie McDaniel. We're leveraging the prioritization policy for folks who have been displaced to bring them back to the east side. They have been able to identify folks who qualify for the one and two bedrooms based on the criteria that most of the folks who do this affordable housing provides. The one selling piece why we push for these condos were the three bedrooms, and they cannot find folks to qualify at the rate that they are asking for. And it's on average, as Councilmember Alvizio shared, 93,000. Three for individuals in the Black community that want to build wealth and understand that they're going to be capped. For a family of three to only be able to make 93,000 to get into these condos with a prioritization policy, with all of the due deference that we've done within the process, they overqualify, and I want them to overqualify. I don't want a family of three living with $93,000 just to somehow get into a condo to build wealth. So then their only other option is to continue renting. And if you look at our council aides, you put one and two of them together, and they get married, and they want to stay in the neighborhoods where their council member's at, they cannot qualify for working family housing in our districts. We're not specifically speaking on that, but I see that as something that we want to get into that discussion when we're, so Councilmember Lewis and I are kicking off our first MPI plan. That's going to be something we're going to be talking about. It's all on the finances. It's all on how do we provide the incentives for this to work. If we're truly looking for folks that live in our communities, that work in the city or county of Denver, to stay, and we create policy to say, hey, this is for you to bring you back after you've been displaced, but yet the financial targets are so low that folks have to be in poverty in order to be able to begin to build wealth. That is not sustainable, and we're missing something, because both of these developments, one, two bedrooms, flying through the window. They cannot, and because they can't do their three bedrooms, they're not hitting the percent of units that they must have filled. And so they're getting into some jeopardy. I shouldn't have said the name of the condos. So I just realized I'd say too much. But disregard where they're at, I'm just simply saying they're doing all the right things, but because of what we're not incentivizing and what the financing around these are providing, they're not being successful. And I think if there are ways we can look at that, I think it'll be great. Wanted to speak to the Globe Lear Swansea community. That community is doing well when it comes to looking at increasing density on single-family lots, because their home values right now are depressed because of all of the horrible institutionalized systems we put in place to keep property values low in GES, as well as for all of the environmental hazards, the cost of doing business there. Folks aren't scraping and building McMansions in GES. They might be doing in other units. They're not doing that. But communities like TR Collectiva and others, they are splitting lots so that families can stay and live in Globe Lear Swansea. So parts of this works in communities that are depressed, not just based on market, but based on some of the institutionalized stuff that we've done within the city. So I see parts of this working, and so I'm agreeing with the focus on based on plans and based on where. This has great application in Park Hill. This may not have as many options for that, because they're not scraping throughout. They may be scraping on Monaco, but most of those single-family homes are stable. So I think looking at what we have for ADUs, look at what we have from the East Area Plan, which has a small section of Park Hill,
how do we actually actualize the outcomes where there is opportunity for more housing stock within those communities? That's something we're going to look towards in our plan, but I appreciate the information. I'm looking for the financial piece, but also how do we target this across the city in the places where it makes sense, which our area plans are providing. I think it's going to be helpful, at least for me, to be able to go back to my community and say, hey, in Cole, in Clayton, in Skyland, North City Park, and in Whittier, which is not part of the area plan, but it's my neighborhood, where can we do this? I look forward to engaging with folks on that.
Thank you. Accept the question?
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the discussion. I think CPD, you've kind of been tasked with the impossible. You know, zoning is a really blunt instrument. And so what I keep hearing at this table is how do we create equitable solutions for people, which is meeting people according to their needs, right? Which is very kind of place-based versus zoning, which is a tool of quality, treat kind of everyone the same. And so I think, you know, to Councilwoman Sawyer's point, I think there's a lot of other solutions that need to be explored, that should be discussed, that will actually solve this problem versus changing our bulk standards. I mean, we just expanded actually building coverage in the last text amendment, I believe, right? Like we can do 60% versus 40%. So reeling that back feels like maybe a taking of someone's entitlement, which I think is dangerous. So I don't necessarily think that the bulk standards are necessarily where we're gonna solve this problem. I think this is the reason why we don't see subdivided properties more is not because it's not easy to do from a zoning perspective, a planning perspective. It's incredibly challenging from a building code perspective. So I think unless we're willing to make some concessions regarding building code, we're not going to see the adaptive reuse that we want, because you have to build it to the current energy code. And guess what? There's no brick building, you know, from the 40s and 50s and 60s that are going to pass that requirement. So that's why it's more a cost-effective to scrape and build new, is because it's more expensive to bring something up to code. And so unless we have meaningful conversations around the tools in our toolbox and how they're implemented and what they cost, I don't think we're going to get to where we are. And so this is why this, in my view, is not necessarily a zoning discussion. Zoning will say this is allowed or it's not allowed. But policy, good policy, is here are the guardrails on private equity, which I heard today, which I think is really important. Relooking at the group living, you know, allowing assisted living to be outside of residential care will help a lot of people that are vulnerable to displacement, and just are vulnerable in general in the city. I mean, these are kind of the policy tools that we really need focus on, and I feel like CPD's trying their best to, well, here's some options, but it's not actually going to solve the problem, because it just won't. And so I think when we have those other policy tools, then go back to CPD and say how can CPD support this policy versus having you kind of do it the reverse, which is kind of how I feel like it's happening right now. And I also agree that some of these other kind of other options, like the, you know, expanding or incentivizing 3 and 4 bedroom apartments, which I think is a great idea. It's really hard to do that outside of, you know, affordable housing, because affordable housing really, you know, LIHTC supports those kinds of developments outside of a market study. You know, incentivizing those things would be easy or easier to do and more impactful to, I think, day-to-day citizens, and I think would have the political will needed to do it. I just think there isn't, I'm kind of agreeing with Mary and others, that there's not really political will, I think, from residents to kind of have this blunt upzoning of all these properties. And so maybe having a policy discussion around what we can do and taking a look at building code to get to those solutions faster than just being like, okay, well, how are we going to do this from the ground up every time, which is what we're
what this is doing now, right? Saying, how do we get the 2 to 9 units? But it's assuming like we're building a brand new building, and then, but like, where does it go? And so if there is things from zoning, I would say we should have max lot areas, back to Fred's point, for single family units instead of minimum lot sizes, which I think is crazy, which is why we see all these rezonings over these little things. And so those are little quick fixes that I think would enable this type of housing faster. And I love the idea of having kind of a off the menu option for ADUs. For permitting on the building permit side, that's really smart. That's kind of what happened with like the tiny home villages, right? We were able to, yep. I think the first model costed $250,000 to build because it had the energy code. And then it got more efficient, right? And now it's mass manufactured. But getting to something like that, you know, talking about how do we improve residential permitting so it's faster, and looking at all these other policy tools, which is really in your court, and then just add, and then having CPD support those things, I think is where the discussion will be most fruitful. Thanks.
Thank you. I don't think we have time to go back around, but one thing that caught my attention to Fred, to your point, who is development for? And in Northwest Denver, it was so complicated that when we upzoned the city in 2010, development for was developers in Jefferson Park. And we took a stable neighborhood, and now it's unstable. And I have the data to back it. So I do these welcome letters that Councilman Sawyer had talked to me about years ago. And so I send a welcome letter, welcome to the neighborhood. But it's actually to see who is buying these lots. And over the years, it's LLCs who buy these lots up. And in Jefferson Park, where you have one house, and now you have 16 units. We upzoned it. It's my least stable neighborhood. And when I say stable, I mean it has more renters. It doesn't have people who own it. They sell, and then there's construction defects all over the place because they were just shoddy construction builders. So I have my husband's friend lives in Jefferson Park, and his roof, every time it rains, it leaks. But he can't replace the whole entire roof because it's six other homeowners, because it's a slot home. And so he has to get permission from six other homeowners to do this repair, and he's fixed it on his right unit, but it's the whole membrane has to be taken off because it's a flat roof, and so then he has to get permission, and he has to pay for the whole entire thing because nobody else's roof is leaky. And so, and then his windows literally leak. Like, literally the siding, like, they literally leak, and so he had to have, and he was on the outside unit where the inside units don't have windows on the outside except for in the front and the back, right? He had to replace his windows, and so now he's in a lot, and so he works in Boulder with my husband, and now it's just a rental. And now every time it rains, and they're like, oh, yeah, I know about that, yeah, no problem. But he lives in Boulder because he doesn't want to deal with it anymore. And so when we look at these policies, I think that one of the key things that I heard was, who is this development for? I mean, I think the residents on this panel, I don't think any of you are developers. I don't think any of you, maybe one of you, can go in and, but not like the Jefferson Park developer where you decimated my whole entire campaign.
Don't want any of you.
It's literally red tea development. Now they're in Councilwoman Alvidres' district. They moved from Jefferson Park, literally picked up their headquarters, and not only did they decimate my council district, they ran over the RNO because the RNO didn't know how to have bylaws, and so the developer had all of his staff, because he owned a building there, join the RNO, and then they started voting for all these rezonings to go through, and because you didn't have to own a property, it was just an RNO who needed help, right? And so they got this developer in there, and then he took over, then he got all his staff to join the RNO, and then every rezoning was mostly the development team at the RNO meeting voting in favor of the RNO, the owner of Red Tea, who was going to redevelop. So then I had to, when Councilman Espinosa was in office, I had to, we had to do this whole entire, like, look at our R&O bylaws. Are your R&O bylaws, like, really shored up so that you don't have a developer who can come in and take over? So I, in Northwest Denver, I think when this project started, I have a couple old 50s, they're brick, they're condos, and they're right next to single-family homes. We don't get complaints about them. There's one on my block off of 44th and Grove. And they're fee simple. They work. They're the size of, like they're kind of small. It's like two houses. We get zero complaints on them. And so when I started looking at our building form, we can't build those anymore. Mm-hmm. We literally cannot build something like that anymore. We can't build a box with two units at the bottom, two units at the top, the main entrance, and a garage on the side for each unit to have its own car. Literally, you can't build that anymore. So to your point, Alicia, I love how you're saying that we need to attack our building form and our building code. Because the most complaints that I get in my council office are not use by right. If you have the use by right, even in my council district where we have higher entitlement, they're not building to the max that they can. They're just not. The market's not following. They're actually building less. But they're coming in for all these variances. I don't know about you all, but my staff watches every single variance that comes into my council district, and we're seeing a pattern of building into the side interior setbacks so that you can get more lot coverage, and you're building into the rear setbacks so that you can get more lot coverage. And so I'm like, well, maybe there's a problem with our form because we keep going to this variance process. And trust me, I updated the whole Board of Adjustment with Robin Kanich because of the variance process, right? And one other thing, Alicia, you said that I'll never forget when I got into council, Councilwoman Kanich kept saying, the reason why everything gets turned down is because it's easier to build brand new to meet our complicated hybrid zoning code. We don't have just one a form-based or FAR. We really have a hybrid zoning code. And it's really a unique, it's kind of unicorn from what I understand from the research that I've done at UC Denver. And so in Councilman Torres's district, when we were working on the West Area Plan and I represented West Colfax, it was getting decimated. Everything was getting torn down because it's easier to build new. I live in a 1943 bungalow. I wish I had 5 bedrooms, Councilman Gilmore. I have 2. I brought my niece in to live with me. She lived on my couch for 2 years because I only have 3 bedrooms. I have 1 in my basement, I have 2 upstairs, I have 1 bedroom. It's like tiny. My kitchen is like the size of that kitchen in there. And my niece, when I had to bring her in to help raise her, she had to live on my couch. She's coming home this winter. My daughter's gonna spend the night for Christmas Eve, and we're like, all right, he thought, well, you're gonna be on the couch and it's gonna be fine. But that's the way we choose to live. That's how I want to live. And so how do we take all of this and what I keep saying to CPD? I feel like this is happening in a bubble. Because if I go out to my neighborhoods, no one's talking about this, except for a couple people. I don't know about you, but are you all having coffee and drinks about unlocking housing choices? You know? I mean, because that's what we're going to have to do. Is we're gonna have to all of us be ambassadors out to this, because if we're gonna be talking about this passing this time next year, that means we're gonna have to do major, major, major outreach in 2026, and every single one of us at this table is gonna be responsible for getting that out into my community, because my staff has been going and asking thoughts on this, and besides the person who's sitting here representing her interest in part of it, I don't know one person who is very excited about this in Northwest Denver from the people that we've been talking to. They're scared, they're nervous, and what they're saying is this is not going to be predictable. And one thing we always, developers tell me is, oh, we want everything to be predictable. And now we're saying, how is this going to be predictable? So how is it going to be predictable? I guess that's my question. The next question around is, developers are always saying that's why they don't want to go for a rezoning, is because it's not predictable, and they want our zoning code to be predictable. Is this going to be predictable? I don't have the answer to that. So I think that's something that I've heard clearly through my council district when we've been asking, and people are just not aware of it. I mean, people are, the federal government shut down, SNAP being pulled aside, all the things that are going on. I mean, even us on council, we were at council last night till 10:30 last night. We had an 8-hour meeting. This wasn't something we were talking about. It was actually the Southwest Area Plan that was the most simple thing that we dealt with. Our Southwest was like literally the simplest thing that we dealt with last night on our agenda. And we had two rezonings. I rezoned Regis. You all just talked about Regis. I held on to that since 2021. From 2021, I worked on that to get it to city council till 2025. So that's what I think about at night that keeps me up, is what are we actually dealing with on our city council hearing, or like during our council meetings? It's not these. It's not these things. It's all of the other policy issues, to your point, on how do we work on them. So I think that gives us some homework. I do think that it's an opportunity. The next meeting is in January. So my staff is going to go to the RNO meetings in January, or in February. My staff's going to go in January to tell all my RNOs to watch it in February. And then in March, they have a break. So then they're going to go back in March and report out to it. And then so they could go in April. And then April, we're almost a quarter way through the year. We better start talking to our constituents. And CPD, I'm just going to ask you to please partner with council members, so that's what we did for redistricting. When Councilman Gilmore was president, I asked her, can I have quadrant meetings, and can I have council members come together and give them like 2 weeks notification? And those meetings were really actually pretty well attended, except for one that we had to cancel because of COVID, because there was a COVID, and we decided, Councilman Gilmore was like, we can't put people at risk because of COVID. But I would really recommend getting those out ahead of time, because if not, I'm afraid it's going to be what with group living, and it's going to fall up on us council members when it comes to our lap to say, hey, you didn't do outreach to our council districts. All right, we went a little bit over. How about I reach out with Luke and we schedule a couple more for 2026? Does that work for you all? Mm-hmm. Sounds good. Thank you.
Thanks guys. Thank you.